From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Indira Lakshmanan. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Ted Cruz doubles down on his very public refusal to endorse Donald Trump last night.
The way to win, as I tried with all my might to lay out last night, is not to just scream and yell and attack as a traitor anyone that would dare question our candidate.
Also today, is Donald Trump the self-made man he and his family say he is?
My father has revitalized rundown neighborhoods, shaped skylines across the country, and turned dreams into reality his entire career.
We'll delve deeper into his biography. Plus, a preview of the new Star Trek movie in theaters tomorrow.
This is my last report as the captain of the Starship Enterprise.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. It's day four of the GOP convention in Cleveland, and today's theme, an echo of the candidate's mantra, is Make America One Again. Tonight, Donald Trump will make his debut as the official Republican nominee. He's taken the votes, but it's not clear everyone there is as taken with his ideas. Last night, when vice presidential nominee Mike Pence was supposed to be the highlight, Senator Ted Cruz stole the show by refusing very publicly to endorse Donald Trump in his speech.
If you love our country and love your children as much as I know that you do, stand and speak and vote your conscience. Vote for candidates up and down the ticket who you trust to defend our freedom and to be faithful to the Constitution.
Cruz was booed off the stage by Trump supporters, and this morning, in a speech to the Texas delegation, he doubled down on his remarks, saying the promise candidates made to support the eventual nominee wasn't unconditional.
That pledge was not a blanket commitment that if you go and slander and attack Heidi, that I'm going to nonetheless come like a servile puppy dog and say thank you very much for maligning my wife and maligning my father.
Joining us now from the convention in Cleveland is WBUR's senior political reporter, Anthony Brooks. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Indira. How you doing?
Great. So, Anthony, you were inside the hall last night during this extraordinary drama of the second most popular Republican candidate withholding support for the winner. What was it like?
Indira, this was extraordinary. This is the third convention that I've covered. I've watched a lot of them over the years, and you just can't expect something to go off the rails like this the way it did last night. I mean, of course, this was the big question all day. Was Ted Cruz going to endorse Trump or was he not? But I don't think anybody quite expected it to go down this way. And that great cut of tape you played right at the beginning where Cruz says, vote your conscience, the boos erupted. And I just happened to be very close to the sort of Trump family box in the VIP sitting area.
Lucky
and suddenly,
you.
I didn't expect it. And suddenly there's all this commotion. And I thought there's a protest and they're hustling someone out. But no, suddenly I'm standing right under Donald Trump, big grin on his face, flashing the thumbs up. The stage goes dark. Ted Cruz leaves. And
wow.
There you have it. I mean, it was really, really, really something.
High drama. And especially because Donald Trump actually tweeted during Ted Cruz's speech that, oh, I saw this speech 2 hours ago, but I let him do it anyway. He broke his pledge, you know, bad. But then when he came out in the moment you saw him, he actually was giving the thumbs up as Ted Cruz finished speaking. It was almost like he was saying, yeah, whatever. He can say what he wants. I'm still the winner.
Well, it's true, and you have to wonder, too. He knew Ted Cruz wasn't going to endorse him. We all saw the advance of that speech at about 9 p.m. You have to wonder if, in Trump's sort of crazy way of thinking about these things, that this was a sense of drama that he almost welcomed. I mean, I don't know how else to think about it.
Well, it also makes him look in a way like the bigger guy, right? He's willing to let the loser have his moment in the spotlight, but at the same time, he's saying, guess what, guys, I won. one. It seems very kind of Game of Thrones, but without the beheading.
Well, it's true. On the other hand, once again, we're all talking about something that just careered so dramatically off script. And, you know, when at a time when the Republican Party needs to be uniting around Donald Trump, it was just evidence of this division with the party. You and I talked about this yesterday, how Ted Cruz represents the sort of right wing of this fractured party, and boy, did he make that clear last night. And it means Donald Trump's got his work cut out for him tonight.
Yeah, well, it also leaves Cruz in a bit of a question mark position. By all accounts, he wants to run again in 2020. But, you know, Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, wasn't so pleased with him, right?
Right. No, Chris Christie really let him have it. And why don't we listen to a little bit about that, and then I can talk about a little more of the fallout today. Here's Chris Christie.
It was an awful, selfish speech by someone who tonight, through the words he said on that stage, showed everybody why he has richly earned the reputation that he has on Capitol Hill.
Now, Indira, that reputation on Capitol Hill is probably among the most least popular senators. But, you know, Ted Cruz then appeared this morning at a Texas delegate breakfast. And keep in mind, these are people who, most of whom voted for Ted Cruz, and they were furious with him. And you played a little bit of that tape at the top. And, you know, Cruz said, look, this isn't a team sport. We don't just put on red jerseys or blue jerseys and say yay. It's really something. So one really wonders where this leaves Ted Cruz.
So you know, you're saying that even Ted Cruz's own supporters weren't happy with him?
No, they were furious at the overall. They were furious at this breakfast. Because look, they're furious because even though at one point they were supporting Ted Cruz, they don't want to elect Hillary Clinton. A lot of people really feel like, you know, if Hillary Clinton ends up winning the presidency by 1 or 2 points. You know, their point is Ted Cruz could have delivered those 1 or 2 points rather than just looking out for Ted Cruz. On the other hand, if Hillary Clinton ends up Trump, you know, really beating Trump decisively, Ted Cruz could be the last guy standing and sort of say, well, you know, this is kind of what I was saying, folks.
That's right.
And it might sort of set him up well for 2012. We'll see. It's a fascinating political
moment.
Well,
given the
polling, high drama.
Given the polling that is showing Hillary Clinton as having a 70-some% chance of winning, you know, it seems like Ted Cruz might be pretty smartly setting himself up for 2020 in that way. Well, Anthony, the vice presidential nominee Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana, tried to counter Cruz's speech with a very positive message about Trump, but I noticed that he got the biggest applause for his critique of Hillary Clinton.
People in both parties are restless for change, ready to break free of old patterns in Washington, and Democrats are about to anoint someone who represents everything this country is tired of. You know, Hillary Clinton wants a better title, and I would too if I was already America's Secretary of the Status Quo.
It's a pretty cute line. You got to give the guy credit, Secretary of the Status Quo. So how did the crowd react to Mike Pence overall?
Yeah, it was pretty positive. And, dear, I agree with you. I thought Pence did a pretty interesting job. You know, one of his first lines was, for those of you who don't know me, which is most of you, I mean, he was very self-deprecating. And another thing he said was, you know, Donald Trump can be a forceful and charismatic character. You know, that must be why he selected me for balance.
I like that because it's kind of the old tradition of making jokes in a political speech, but jokes at your own expense.
Absolutely. And what I heard from the delegates was, you know, very, very positive. They liked the idea that he sort of provides balance. One delegate said Pence offers an element of balance to Trump. He's calm. He's understated. He's a real conservative with Washington experience, real executive experience. So folks like that. But of course, there was real concern that, you know, instead of Pence being the big story last night, it was Ted Cruz.
It was Cruz. Well, there was another big story last night, which was the U.S. Secret Service is conducting an investigation into comments made by Republican New Hampshire State Representative Al Baldessaro, who said this on Wednesday on WRKO.
This whole thing disgusts me. Hillary Clinton should be put in the firing line and shot for treason.
Whoa. So he is not just a Republican delegate, but he's a surrogate for Donald Trump. But he's out there advocating that Hillary Clinton be shot. I mean, Baldessaro is part of the country's biggest state legislature. Listeners may not know, but 424 New Hampshire representatives are paid $100 a year for their service. Tell us what you know about Baldessaro.
Yeah, well, this is a really sort of shocking comment, and depending on who you talk to, you get a lot of different response. But here's what we know about Baldessaro. As you said, he's a state representative. He was a regular fixture at all Donald Trump rallies in New Hampshire leading up to the primary. I saw a lot of them. Trump always singled him out as a great guy. He's standing up for the veterans, a real ally of Donald Trump's. Now, that said, the Trump campaign has made the point this week that Baldessaro does not speak for the Trump campaign. But these comments were really something. And a lot of people have approached him here on Media Row in Cleveland. And he's doubled down on those comments and hasn't backed away from them and said, yeah, she should face a firing squad because she committed treason. This is all about the emails and all about the Benghazi scandal. The Democrats are saying that this is an example of what happens when Trump sort of ratchets up this kind of unfiltered, aggressive political speech.
And riles up a base to say things like threatening the life of a presidential candidate that doesn't really seem like it's on. All right. Well, tonight, briefly, we're expecting speeches by Silicon Valley venture capitalist Peter Thiel, Ivanka Trump, the first daughter of Donald Trump, and Donald Trump himself. So in the brief moments we have left, what are you expecting and what do tonight's speeches need to do that you haven't seen yet?
Okay, in terms of what I'm expecting, I've given up making those kinds of prognostications this week. You know, here's what I'll say. Donald Trump has to find a way to sort of emerge as being seen as in control of this convention. Because right now, every day, the story has been about a floor fight. Melania Trump's allegations of copying speeches. And then, you know, the Ted Cruz drama. Donald Trump has to make a coherent argument about why Americans should choose him as commander-in-chief, rather than have us tomorrow talking about the next unexpected kind of drama to come out of Cleveland. So that's what we'll be watching for.
All right. We will be watching with you and waiting for the full report tomorrow. That's WBUR's senior political reporter, Anthony Brooks, sticking it out for us in Cleveland. Thanks so much, Anthony.
Always a pleasure, Indira. Thank you.
For one reaction to Ted Cruz's address last night, we spoke with John Civilella. He's a Republican delegate from Marco Rubio from Massachusetts and a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute, a free market think tank in Boston. He's also a contributor to WBUR's opinion page, Cognoscenti. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Indira.
So Ted Cruz, who campaigned as a social conservative, who appealed to evangelicals, he laid bare some pretty deep divisions within the party last night. Not only did he decline to endorse Trump, but he called on Republicans to, quote, vote your conscience, which sounded to me like a veiled dig at Trump, who we all remember called Ted Cruz Lion Ted. So I'm wondering, do you think that that could hurt the party's chances in November with Republicans who are wavering still about Trump?
I think it could. I mean, that was the first reaction on the floor. It took a moment for people to digest what he had said, and then the floor really erupted. You know, it was absolutely bizarre scene.
Erupted in boos, you mean?
Yeah, booed and jeered and start chanting, you know, say his name, Trump's
mm-hmm.
name.
Were you one of those people cheering and booing?
No, I was observing everything.
Well, let me ask you, because you've been critical of Trump for mocking people with disabilities, for calling a judge biased simply because he's Latino and proposing a ban on entering this country based on religion. But you've also criticized Republican leadership for failing to appeal to the same base that Trump attracted. So how much of Trump's success is really the fault of the GOP elite?
I think it's a symptom of those failings, in a sense. I think somebody was going to jump into that populist track. The fact that the GOP elite for quite a while had ignored a lot of those issues kind of left this vacuum for somebody to fill.
Well, many Republican leaders from Massachusetts are sitting out this convention, apparently, because of their opposition to Trump. Is that a cop-out in your view, or even a missed opportunity for people like Governor Charlie Baker?
I don't necessarily think it's a cop-out from his perspective. I think it's, you know, staying home and doing the work there. Where I think that might differ in a qualitative sense is for former presidential candidates.
It sounds like you mean Mitt
yeah.
Romney.
The whole crew, like the Bush family and McCain and Romney, it's not so much a criticism, it's really more like an observation. You know, it's an opportunity.
Well, what is the opportunity they're missing?
If you have a different view on how the party should be run, or if you have certain policies you think should be in effect, or, you know, if you think a candidate saying, you know, intemperate things or inappropriate things, come out and talk.
All right. Well, let me ask you. Trump did win a record number of Republican primary votes, 37 states, including Massachusetts, where he carried 50% of the Republican primary votes. So isn't it time now to support the candidate? I mean, isn't that what this convention is all about?
I think it's an ongoing debate, you know, in the convention. There is a group and a faction that absolutely kind of came around. There are still others who are not there.
What about you?
I'm not there yet. I'm just not there. Some of the statements and things that he has said in the past, I find difficult to get over. And I haven't necessarily seen anything out here in that regard to kind of get me personally over those hurdles yet.
So fair enough. Do you think that means that you would stay home in November, or would you vote for Hillary?
I would not vote for Hillary Clinton. I would always vote. Don't know whether you have to consider abstaining at the top of the ticket or not. So that's a possibility.
Is there anything that Trump could say tonight that would change your mind?
I don't know. But what I would be looking for are, like, really significant and strong messages of unity, not just in the party, but across the country as well.
John Civilella is a delegate for Marco Rubio and a political science professor at Columbia University. He's also a contributor to WBUR's opinion page, Cognoscenti. You can find links to his writing on our website, radioboston.org. Thanks so much for joining us, John.
Thank you, Indira.
I want to turn now to another Massachusetts delegate, Vincent DeVito. This is his fourth convention, and he's an ardent Trump supporter. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to speak with you.
Absolutely. So, Vincent, I want you to respond to some of what John Civilella just said. But first, what did you think of Ted Cruz's speech? Was it wrong of him to expose remaining fractures within the party?
There really aren't remaining fractures within the party. Senator Cruz's speech was one of the least impactful convention speeches that I've ever witnessed.
Because you think that he has such a small minority of people behind him?
He definitely has a small minority of people behind him. Besides that, the speech yesterday was political suicide. Donald Trump invited every one of the contenders to speak at the convention. He accepted, and he chose to do what he wanted to do, what he thought was in his best interest. It was impolite, and it did not resonate with the Republican Party. It did not resonate at all with any of the conventioners.
So it came off as kind of sour grapes, in your view, to be invited by the winner and yet to refuse to come over to his camp.
Yes, you nailed it. You know, jealousy is a very destructive emotion, and last night was a casebook study of that.
All right. Well, you just heard one of your fellow delegates from Massachusetts say that he's not there yet in terms of supporting Trump because of painful or divisive rhetoric that Trump has used. Governor Charlie Baker has said he won't vote for Trump and he might even leave the top of the ballot blank in November. Are you worried about what this kind of disunity or these holdouts could do to the party's chances of winning in November?
No, absolutely not, because the fundamentals of this election are basically already settled political science. And there is not disunity coming out of this convention. There was unity coming into this convention. As you may know, I was on the Rules Committee. And we had a thorough and respectful discussion of all the issues on the Rules Committee. I had always known in advance of the Rules Committee that the Never Trump movement really never was. It was only a handful of folks. Comparative to the same position I had 4 years ago, there was no passion behind the Never Trump movement like there was behind the Ron Paul supporters in Tampa. And as a result, the voting on the Rules Committee was lopsided in the favor of Trump and the RNC. In fact, RNC and Trump formally merged and unified in advance of the Rules Committee meeting, and it's been a celebratory and energetic and electrifying convention from the beginning.
Well, let me ask you, let me interrupt you for a second, because your fellow delegate, John Civilella, who supported Marco Rubio, his position is that if the party wants to grow and not just be the sort of less than half of America that it is demographically now by the numbers, that particularly because of the changing face of America, the fact that there are more minorities than ever before, that someone like Marco Rubio, a sort of young Latino, diverse face is necessary, given that Trump has alienated a lot of Latinos and a lot of black voters. How does he make the Republican Party of the future a big tent?
I don't know if that premise is accurate. I haven't seen polling that would reflect such a thing. I'll say this, as I think the world knows now, Donald Trump has received more votes than any candidate running for the Republican nomination in history. He is expanding the electorate. He's outperforming every metric of John McCain and Mitt Romney across the board. Hillary Clinton is underperforming every metric of Barack Obama. The contest is between a grassroots candidate, Donald Trump, and the likely Democratic nominee, a grasstops candidate, Hillary Clinton. We are putting the movement candidate, the change candidate, out front, and the Democrats are likely going to put the establishment candidate. This is a contest between status quo and change. And Donald Trump is leading a movement, he'll tell you himself. And I've witnessed it. These folks are excited. This convention is energy. People are literally dancing in the aisles.
Wow, it sounds very, very exciting. You make the point that Trump won a record number of Republican primary votes, 13 million nationwide, but more than 15 million other Republicans in the primaries chose either Ted Cruz, John Kasich, or Marco Rubio. So Trump got less than half of his party's support. What do you think he needs to say tonight? The theme is, you know, make America one again, unity. What does he need to say to get people to rally behind him tonight, quickly, in the short time we have left?
Yeah, quickly. Well, your premise is a half empty type of perspective. Really, he got that amount of votes with a huge field. Right? You're getting record amount of votes with a lot of people spread out across the board. But quickly, the party is unified. He will explain exactly how he is in touch with the American psyche and where American voters want the country to go next. Donald Trump is their messenger. He's their guy. He's going to win in November. He is uniquely in touch and has tapped into what the American voters want in the next president.
Vincent DeVito is a Trump delegate from Wellesley. Thank you so much for joining us from Cleveland.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. Tonight at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, party nominee Donald Trump will cap off this giant four-day party with what is perhaps the biggest speech of his campaign. He said he'll probably use a teleprompter for the speech, a rare departure because he's mocked other politicians for doing so in the past. His off-the-cuff, bombastic, and often polarizing speeches are part of what has won him so many supporters. That behavior is nothing new for Mr. Trump. In fact, even when he was a boy, he would throw birthday cake at parties and erasers at teachers. That's from reporting by Matt Visor, who covers national politics for the Boston Globe. He wrote recently about Donald Trump's drive to surpass his father's success on the front page of the Sunday Boston Globe, and he joins us now from Cleveland to dive deeper into Donald Trump's biography. Thanks so much for joining us, Matt.
Hey, Indira. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I want to begin with a piece of tape from Donald Trump Jr.'s speech on Tuesday night that really encapsulates for listeners how the Trump campaign has promoted the candidate's business background.
I know that when people tell him it can't be done, that guarantees that he gets it done. I know that when someone tells him that something is impossible, that's what triggers him into action. When people told him it was impossible for a boy from Queens to go to Manhattan and take on developers in the big city, rather than give up, he changed the skyline of New York.
All right, so a can-do guy who won't take no for an answer and who always negotiates the best deal for himself. Is that what you found when you dug into his business background?
There's an aspect of that that is true, although it should be said that Donald Trump sort of followed in the footsteps of his father, who was a very successful developer himself in Queens and in Brooklyn and near Coney Island in New York. His father started Trump out with $1 million loan. He helped him with political contacts. There was a lot of help that Donald Trump got very early on from his dad. That said, Donald Trump had different dreams that were bigger and broader than his father. And he did make the move to go into Manhattan, which was a different type of real estate world than his father across the river.
Well, let's talk a little bit about his dad, Fred Trump, because you really gave some very interesting reporting about him being a pretty humble guy. Fred apparently went to construction sites, picked up loose nails off the ground, made sure that workers would reuse them next week, and even helped build some of his early housing developments.
Yeah, so Fred Trump, Donald Trump's father, got started out at a very young age. His own father died when he was 12 years old. So he sort of assumed a lot more responsibility at a young age and started doing construction and building prefabricated two-car garages for $50 in the neighborhood, and sort of used that to expand and eventually was doing huge apartment complexes and bigger buildings. But Fred Trump was a sort of a quieter guy, not a showy guy. He wore suits, as Donald Trump does. He's businesslike, but he was not as bombastic and showy as his son. One early story that Fred Trump has relayed about Donald was about a baseball glove. Donald Trump wanted to buy a $35 baseball glove, and Fred Trump...
friend, right? When he was a little boy. So this was like in, what, the 1950s or 60s?
Yeah, in the 50s. Donald Trump wanted this glove for his friend, and Fred Trump couldn't believe it. He would only get him a $5 glove, and he took him to the shop, and as Fred Trump tells it, Donald Trump about threw up once he saw the $5 glove. He couldn't stand it.
But $35 for a birthday present in the 1950s for a kid's birthday, that's pretty shocking.
Yeah,
you describe Fred Trump as a modest man, and yet at the same time, he was pretty well known. In 1950, you report that the Fashion Foundation of America named him one of the country's best dressed men alongside then General Dwight Eisenhower.
Yeah, so I mean, there was a little bit of a flashy side to Fred Trump. He drove a Cadillac, and he would get a new Cadillac just about every year. You know, there was a period. Fred Trump grew up fairly poor, but became quite wealthy. The house that Donald Trump grew up in was a big one, sort of a mansion in Jamaica Estates. But Fred Trump did have a little bit of flash to him, and he was very well known and very politically connected in the real estate world. But he didn't always want to capture the headlines. I mean, he wanted to have the connections in order to get zoning things changed or get FHA loans from the government. You know, it's sort of nitty gritty stuff that was a lot different from the sort of pathway that Donald pursued.
Well, I'm struck that, you know, the father became a millionaire, but the son became a billionaire. And it seems like from a very young age, I mean, his dad built these sort of low income housing developments, and the son said, "No way, I'm not going to stick to Queens and the outer boroughs. I want to build on the skyline of Manhattan." I mean, how early was that known? You tell one anecdote in your story about the very young Donald Trump and his brother in building blocks. This one was shocking to me. Tell us the story.
Yeah, so Donald Trump, this is a story that Donald Trump has relayed about when he was a kid, and they were using building blocks, and Donald Trump needed more blocks. And so he asked his brother, his younger brother, if he could borrow some, and his brother said, sure. So Donald Trump builds this tower, and he likes it so much that he glues all of the blocks together. And so Donald says that was the end of, you know, Robert, his brother's blocks. You know?
But what's incredible is that he's proud of this story, that he stole his brother's blocks, and his brother said, you better give them back, and he just didn't. But he tells this story as a badge of honor, it seems.
Yeah, and I mean, and story after story, and Donald Trump seems to know and sort of recognize he was a quite polarizing figure in the neighborhood. You know, I mean, he was kind of, a brat, you know, as his sister is sometimes described him. You know, so he he at an early age kind of was like we see now in some ways. And at one point his father sent him away to a military school when Donald was a teenager. So I think that was another formative experience for Donald, is sort of that feeling a little bit of rejection from the family, you know, being sent away and having to prove himself in a different type of environment and live up to his father's expectations, which kind of he's been trying to do his entire life.
Interesting. Well, I mean, I'm struck by two different things that you report that Donald Trump said. On the one hand, he said, "I'd rather sell apartments to billionaires on Fifth Avenue than apartments to people in Brooklyn who are nice people, but they're going to, you know, nickel and dime me for every penny." But then he also said, "The working man likes me because he knows I didn't inherit what I've built." How can that be, given that his father got him started with $1 million and also bailed him out with, you know, the casino chips in one of the stories you tell?
Yeah, I mean, he clearly benefits from his father and his father's assistance. Donald Trump would say, you know, as he did when I asked him a similar question, that he did have benefits and he turned it into much bigger benefits. You know, I mean, he started out with something and built it into a greater empire, which you could argue that. I think he tends to downplay completely the help that he got from his father, and act as if, you know, he did all of this himself, which he didn't. I mean, he lived with his parents right after graduating from Wharton, you know, and was sort of an apprentice to his father for 5 or 6 years before making that decision to go to Manhattan. And even after that, his father would sign financial documents. He bailed him out with purchasing casino chips at one of his Atlantic City casinos to help Trump avert bankruptcy. You know, so there was a lot of help that he got from his father. But I think that the appeal that Trump has, that plain spokenness that does have an appeal to working class voters, I think comes a little bit out of from his father and the way that his father's business was conducted.
You know, aside from the money, there are other qualities and values that Donald Trump says he's inherited from his father. He says the work ethic, that his dad worked hard all his life. But you also write about Fred Trump having some pretty sexist attitudes. Is there any, I don't know, remnant or echo of that in Donald Trump himself? Tell us, you know, what's the backstory on the dad and sexism?
The interesting thing to that is that it's a little bit counterintuitive to the Donald Trump reputation. This was Donald Trump had hired a woman to be a project manager in the 1980s to build Trump Tower. And
that was very unusual in the 1980s to have a female project manager in construction, right?
Yeah. It certainly was. And Fred Trump had issues mostly because she was a woman and she was so well paid. And so as the woman, Barbara Ress, tells it, Fred Trump forced Donald to lower her salary by $6,000, so that Fred Trump, she wouldn't be making more than Fred Trump's highest paid man. And so she writes that Donald Trump made up the difference personally, sort of off the books, so that Fred Trump wouldn't know about that. And that tells us a couple of things. I mean, one, it is interesting that Donald Trump is still willing to pay a female construction manager better than his father wanted him to. But the other thing is that he sort of hid it from his dad. You know, he didn't want to disobey his father in a way that his father would know about, but he would sort of go around his back to sort of pay the construction manager more.
Fascinating. Yeah. Well, for a long time, you talk about how Fred Trump hid the family's German heritage and claimed that the family was Swedish, and Donald Trump perpetuated that myth for many years. Tell us why.
So this was came out of a period post-World War II when Fred Trump was trying to rent a lot of apartments to Jews, and it was not a good time where you wanted to be a German in the United States. And so Fred Trump would tell people he was Swedish, that his family came from Sweden, which is not true. Fred Trump's father, Frederick, came from Germany. So that sort of perpetuated for many years. And
so he wanted to pretend he wasn't German because of Jewish tenets. basically. Yes. He didn't want to alienate them. Okay.
Yeah. And then Donald Trump in 1987, when he wrote The Art of the Deal, put in there that his family came from Sweden, you know, which was not true. And by then, you know, didn't matter quite so much. Donald Trump later corrected that in a later book, about a decade later. But they were perpetuating this myth of being from Sweden almost up until the point I talked to Donald Trump's one of his cousins, who's sort of a family historian. And he said that they even got letters, you know, from an organization in Sweden that wanted to do a museum exhibit on the Trumps, you know, to celebrate them being from Sweden. So he went to Donald and Fred and sort of said, we got to cut this out. Like, you know, we can't keep perpetuating this lie, really, you know.
Well, you mentioned the book Art of the Deal, which he co-wrote with a man named Tony Schwartz, who was a very successful young magazine writer at the time. There is an interview coming out in next week's New Yorker where Tony Schwartz basically describes his regret at having helped, in his words, make the myth of Donald Trump. And he says that there's a fundamental aspect of Donald Trump that it's impossible to keep him focused on any topic other than himself and his own self-aggrandizement for more than a few minutes. Is that what you have found in studying his biography? Is it all basically about Donald Trump himself? Is it about ego?
There's an awful lot in his biography that is about ego. You know, if you look at The Apprentice or you know, his buildings, you know, there was
giant Trump signs.
They're all Trump. And it should be said, his father didn't do that. Not many of his father's building complexes had the Trump name on them. So that was something that Donald did far more than his father in sort of building these big monuments almost to himself, you know, with his own name on them. I think over the years there has been a lot about Donald Trump that he has pursued his own dreams and his own self-aggrandizement, as Tony Schwartz said. That is sort of striking comments coming from a ghostwriter for a book that, you know, sort of has made Donald Trump's career and reflects a lot of his psychology, I think. I think that changed Donald Trump's own way that he thinks about himself, you know, almost, because he references that book so often.
Well, quick last question. You know, tonight is Donald Trump's big speech, his big moment to shine. And what makes his biography important and, you know, whether narcissism is part of that, really the only reason the American people care is about what it would make him be as a leader, as a president. So what's the sort of nugget you want us to take away from what you learned about his biography and what it would tell us about him as president?
I mean, I think, you know, over the years, there's an interesting parallel where the story starts with Donald Trump building Trump Tower, and he built it all in glass, and his father didn't understand that. His father used brick, and it was cheap brick, you know, and he couldn't understand why his son was spending so much money on this glass that was so opulent. And so he encouraged Donald to use brick instead, which Donald did not do, you know. And so Donald has a flashiness to him that his father did not have. And in some ways, he's trying to change the Republican Party in a way that's more flashy. You know, you see the Republican Party's used brick for a long time, and Donald's trying to change it into glass in a way.
Into the bronze-tinted glass. All right. Yeah. Well, with that, Matt Weiser is a national political correspondent for the Boston Globe. You can read his reporting on Donald Trump's biography on our website, radioboston.org. Matt, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. There's much more ahead. Coming up, a preview of the new Star Trek movie coming to theaters tomorrow. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. Black clergy leaders today gathered at Boston Police Headquarters to thank officers for showing restraint this week during two tense but nonviolent interactions with people who were carrying fake guns. Reverend Mark Scott is associate pastor of the Azusa Christian Community.
It is training, it is discipline, it is policy, it is practice, it is attitude, it is courage that allows that to happen. It's not an accident.
The show of solidarity comes after a number of high-profile shootings of black men by police elsewhere in the country and then targeted attacks on law officers in Dallas and Baton Rouge in recent weeks. Here in Boston, regular gatherings known as Walks for Peace have become weekly routines in places like Dorchester, Charlestown, and Mattapan. The walks, started last year in response to gun violence, are opportunities for city residents and police to come together in shows of solidarity. WBUR's Bruce Gellerman joined the Walk for Peace this week in East Boston.
They came by ones and twos, dog walkers, people with canes, joggers, clergy, and cops, as they have every Tuesday night at 6 for the past 8 weeks. Gathering at the police station near Maverick Square.
And whoever shows up, we go out. Sometimes it's been just a couple people. Sometimes it's been, 100 or so.
Reverend David Searles is pastor of Central Assembly of God Church. He says the weekly walks are a way to alleviate urban isolation.
So the peace walk becomes a place where we're inviting people, hey, come outside your house, be on the sidewalk, meet some people, join together. Good stuff happens when we start building relationships.
We want peace. We don't want any more violence.
Sandra Niger, originally from El Salvador, helps organize the walks because she says gang violence has repeatedly hit close to home.
In our community here in East Boston, we've had about 5-6 teenagers killed. We want to put an end to that.
Heavenly Father, we thank you for gathering us here today as a community.
Father Tom Domerat, pastor at Most Holy Redeemer Parish, offered a prayer for peace in English and Spanish. It was a blessing for East Boston residents, city officials, and the safety of police officers.
Amen.
It does make a difference. I mean, certainly looking at the crowd tonight, we've doubled, minus the police officers, we've doubled what we had last week. So it's making a difference, people being out in the community.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh participates in many of the peace walks.
As you're walking around, you're going to see shop owners, we're going to see residents, we're going to see people. People like seeing people walking around the neighborhood, and people are asking questions. What's that all about? It's a peace walk. What's a peace walk about? It's about wanting peace in our neighborhoods.
There's only one mayor in Boston.
There he is. Mr. Walsh.
How are you doing?
And I think, every community has little different issues they're dealing with, and I think this is a good thing to do.
For East Boston, the mayor said it's building trust between residents, especially teens and police officers. And what started with a small number of peace walkers slowly grew larger as people like Dave Gore watched and joined in. He's a man with a long, pointed gray beard. He wore a black Live Free or Die t-shirt with a ghostly skull image.
I did just heard about it just now. Yeah. That's why I got out of my car and came here.
Why are you doing this?
Why am I doing it? For my community. This is my community. It's where I live. Worried about kids, and I'm worried about the police officers, too. It's a danger life right now, so I walk with them.
They walked quietly and carried signs. Teen lives matter. No more deaths. No more killings. There were no chants, no slogans, and as they passed the playground, kids came to see what was happening. Officers in uniform gave them high fives and explained they were on a peace walk.
Hi, police!
How you doing? High five.
Hello.
The kids were quick learners. They got the message.
Freedom and love and no danger.
And for no people get died.
And no bad guys.
Yeah.
Boston Police Superintendent Kevin Buckley looked on as he walked for peace.
Try to make an impact.
Do you think it makes an impact? Make a difference?
I think it does. I think it does.
I mean, honestly, how?
How? People feel safe. People are welcoming. We also get people that come out and join us as we walk along because they want to be part of the process. They want to be part of the solution. And that's what we're looking for. Everybody to get involved, more hands, makes light work. And that's kind of like what we're looking to do.
They walked for an hour, for more than a mile. And then they returned to the police station at Maverick Square, where they shared pizza and Salvadoran meat pies. Together, they had taken a small step towards peace.
WBUR's Bruce Gellerman.
Space, a final frontier.
It was 50 years ago that Star Trek the TV series first aired across America.
These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise.
introducing us to Captain Kirk, Spock, and the crew of the Starship Enterprise, who have remained our space-age companions for the last half century.
To boldly go where no man has gone before.
Tomorrow, Star Trek Beyond, the third movie in a rebooted Star Trek film franchise, opens in theaters. Pop culture writer Ethan Gilsdorf is a contributor to WBUR's The Artery and the Boston Globe, and he joins us now from Rhode Island Public Radio to give us a peek at the new film. Welcome to Radio Boston, Ethan.
Thanks for having me, Indira.
Absolutely. So you grew up watching the TV series and the films that followed. How does the newest movie compare to the classic Star Trek episodes?
Well, that's a great question because, of course, I think for a lot of fans, there's always that interesting thing that goes on in their mind between, you know, their vision of the franchise and kind of the reality. This is yet another adventure in the series, and it feels very much in the spirit of the original series as well as in the other. Well, there's been a total now of 13 films that have been made over the years in addition to, you know, the various television series. So it's another continuing adventure.
Well, I've seen film critics write that the new movie doesn't break boundaries, but that's not a bad thing. The Boston Globe's film critic Ty Burr wrote, "Star Trek Beyond plays like an episode of the old Star Trek TV series. This, I submit, is what's so enjoyable about it." Do you agree?
I do. And actually, there's a funny moment that the new movie Star Trek Beyond opens with Captain Kirk. Chris Pine plays Captain Kirk, and he's sort of musing about life in space and sort of the problems of staying engaged with his job. And he sort of says things have started to feel a little episodic here on the USS Enterprise. And it's a nice little tongue-in-cheek nod to this, but you're absolutely right. And I think Ty's right as well. I mean, there's not a lot of new ground being broken here. I think some of the same themes, some of the same ideas, the reasons why we love these characters and love the show are all in display here. There's all that wonderful interaction between Kirk and Spock and Dr. McCoy and, of course, a new villain to conquer, strange new worlds to explore. It's all there.
All right. Well, let's listen to a clip from Star Trek Beyond. Here's Chris Pine as Captain Kirk.
I know this isn't the last of my crew. But this is my last report as the captain of the Starship Enterprise.
Ooh, drama. Same character, slightly different scenario, of course, different actors. What are the main obstacles that the characters face in this version, Star Trek Beyond?
So in this version, the USS Enterprise is receives a distress call from another alien race. They go off to check it out, and the menacing villain named Krall, who's played behind a mask, so you can't quite see his face, by Idris Elba, is the nemesis, and you know the Enterprise ends up crash landing on this planet, and they have to figure out a way off the planet. And what's interesting about this one is the crew members sort of get scattered into different configurations that you wouldn't normally expect. So Spock and Bones are kind of stranded together. Kirk and Chekhov are stranded together. And Sulu and Uhuru, as well as Scotty back, you know, on a different ship that he discovers with another local native alien warrior woman. So, you know, they're all kind of there together doing what I think many of us remember from the original series, as well as the reboot movies. You know, living by their wits and trying to solve a problem to kind of figure out a way to defeat the villain and get back together again.
All right. Well, Boston does have a unique connection to Star Trek that not everyone might know about. The actor who played the original Spock grew up here. That's Leonard Nimoy. And a couple years ago, he spoke to Radio Boston about the neighborhood where he grew up.
I wish I could go back to my roots. I can't. They're gone. I'm still emotionally connected to what it was when I was living there and when I left Boston, which was 1949. I was 18 years old and left the West End.
And then Bostonians have another Trekkie experience to look forward to, William Shatner, who was, of course, the original and, in my view, the best ever. Captain Kirk is going to attend the Boston Comic Convention in August. Here he is in a 1968 Star Trek episode, Return to Tomorrow, in which the characters are trying to decide whether to make contact with a new planet.
Dr. McCoy is right in pointing out the enormous danger potential in any contact with life and intelligence as fantastically advanced as this. But I must point out that the possibilities, the potential for knowledge and advancement is equally great.
In your Boston Globe article on Star Trek's 50th anniversary, you wrote that even William Shatner is amazed that people still love Star Trek half a century later. He says the fact that you and I are talking about it half a century later is a phenomenon beyond belief. Why? Why does it still resonate with us now?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And I did have a chance to interview Shatner, and we talked about this a little bit. And if absolutely, you know, what you just said is true. He didn't really expect that this was going to last much longer than the three seasons that it lasted on television. And in fact, it, had a very short life in its original run. And I think that one of the things he mentioned was that the show was very adept at kind of finding a way to comment on current social problems, whether it's racial unrest or the Vietnam War, through the guise of these episodes of these, you know, foreign explorations and strange new worlds. That was an important aspect of the show. And the other was that simply, you know, it provided a model for cooperation and everybody, you know, working together across race, across nationality and ethnicity to boldly go where no one has gone before and to be, you know, part of something big.
And we will be going there again this weekend. Line up for your tickets. I'm so excited. Thank you so much for joining us. Ethan Gilsdorf, a contributor to WBUR's The Artery and a contributor to the Boston Globe. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. Join us tomorrow.